This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. Talking about four upcoming literary bookish events. Well, since we have four, usually I manage two if I'm lucky, I'm going to speed it up pretty quickly. The first one is honoring the publication of the book Shaking the Gates of Hell, Faith-Led Resistance to Corporate Globalization. It's by local United Methodist minister Sharon Delgado, and it covers exactly what the subject describes, the situation, the dire situation that corporate globalization is leading the world into, and ways that she thinks that a Christian point of view can help overcome these. She's going to be presenting her book next week on Wednesday, the 24th of October, at the bookseller in Grass Valley at 3 p.m. If you want to know more about that, you can call 272-2131. Not going to talk much more, but get straight to my talk with her. We talked last week, and she has a lot of interesting things to say.
Your book is divided into three sections, and the first one is called The Gates of Hell. Your whole idea is that you are trying to shake the gates of hell. What are the gates of hell?
The gates of hell are the future opening up that we're facing and heading towards if we don't turn things around. It's the direction that our dominant institutions are leading us toward, which is a future of climate change, environmental destruction of different kinds, lost biodiversity, toxic pollution, inequity, violence, terror, and war. All of the things that we are reading about in the newspapers every day. And so that's why I'm calling on people, particularly people of faith, to challenge that future and create sustainable and compassionate alternatives.
And you don't look at this just in a political way. You specifically call these developments undoing creation.
Yes, undoing creation. That is a term by William Stringfellow, who I draw from heavily in this book. He has helped shape my theology over the years. And yes, undoing creation, that's what he calls the work, what the powers that be are doing. They are creating a different future than what human beings actually want. And that's why we need to understand the institutions and structures of our world, the so-called powers that be, because they essentially take on a life of their own. And unless human beings are responsible for the institutions in which we live and from which we benefit and in which we participate, they take us in the direction that no individual human being wants to see.
When you talk about the powers, you're actually using this as a biblical term, that Stringfellow has brought into the modern world. In the New Testament, these are the powers that St. John in particular saw as destroying his world or the world he wanted to be in. Now you've taken it to apply to the forces in the modern world that are leading to globalization. And you seem to feel that they, even though they are so powerful, in a sense, they're non-directed.
That's right. And even people who are supportive of the global economy and corporate, what I call corporate globalization, the kind of globalization that is dominated by corporate power, even though they support it, they essentially say it's on automatic, that it has taken on a life of its own. Thomas Friedman says there's no one in the driver's seat. And the thing is that if we, in a sense that's true, but there are human beings that participate in these institutions at every level, even at the highest level. And we, as people who live in this world, and particularly in the United States, have a responsibility to challenge and to try and change the rules by which these institutions are playing. The corporations are helping create the rules of the global economy, which have emerged from the United States, and corporations help shape the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, and set those rules of the global economy that all countries are supposed to follow. And corporations are dominant in our military-industrial complex, in our prison-industrial complex, and so challenging corporate power is a big part of what we need to do. It is different than the original writers of Scripture, but our worldview is different as well. And those powers, those forces that seem to be demonic, that seem to be floating around there in the air, aren't. They are emerging from the actual institutions in which we live. Those powers are not anonymous. They are concrete, embodied, incarnate in institutions and in representative human beings.
You quote Thomas Friedman, who's one of the main cheerleaders of globalization and is a really talented phrase maker, but I think he might not understand some of the implications of what he's saying. One of the quotes you give from him is, there couldn't be McDonald's around the world without McDonnell Douglas. And he acknowledges that the globalization is dependent on military force, but he doesn't seem to realize the implications of that.
Yeah, I think Thomas Friedman does understand the implications, but he judges the implications differently than I do. Thomas Friedman sees that there are a lot of downsides to what's going on, and he talks about trying to repair some of those downsides. He sees it as the best possibility in this time because he sees globalization as inevitable. And I'm talking about economic globalization here, and so is he. He sees it as inevitable. Actually, as a person of faith, that's part of why I feel I can challenge this freely, because I don't see that anything that's human constructed is inevitable. I believe that there is a greater power, and that power is working through human beings, and to the degree that we are willing and faithful and open to the guidance of the Spirit, that we can actually have an effect in our world.
The whole concept of faith-based political action has gotten a bit of a bad name in the last 6 or 7 years because of the way it's been tied in with the Bush administration. But you put a very positive spin on it, but your type of faith is not supporting armies, is not supporting arms makers, it's moving against them. How do you speak to the sorts of Christians who have been so dominant in the last 5 or 6 years? Your views of the world are so completely different. Can you communicate with them?
Sometimes yes, and sometimes no. I know that there are many well-meaning, concerned, loving people who believe in Jesus and want to do good, and who have different beliefs than I do. So I'm not challenging people's, you know, what their hearts are. But I do take issue with some of the teachings of fundamentalist Christianity, and I say fundamentalist, I should perhaps say literalist interpretations of Christianity, because there is no such thing as beliefs that are truly based on the Bible without interpretation. Everyone interprets. And I think that teachings that say that you have to take the Bible literally, you can't believe in evolution and really be a Christian. Those kinds of things, hoops that you have to jump through to be accepted as a follower of Christ, I think those are ridiculous and harmful, because we can't give up our ability to think, our own individual experience as well. And the people that are telling you to take the Bible literally are only too happy to interpret it for you and tell you what you should think. And the political right has taken huge advantage of well-meaning people to impose their political agenda on them without question. And it's frightening to me. It's like Carl Jung warned against that. If we take things uncritically and give up our own powers of discernment, we're just setting ourselves up for totalitarianism. And I think that a lot of people have been waylaid. Maybe it serves their own self-interest in some ways, and it is dominant. That's almost all you hear on the airwaves. But I do take issue with those teachings. They aren't biblical to me. I think they're not based on the Bible. They're based on authority of church, that is, people in particular churches who will impose their way of thinking and insist that people think the way they do.
You mentioned William Stringfellow a little earlier. He's not very well known, but he's had an immense influence on you, and from looking at some of the other people who you quote, he seems to have had a very great influence on modern or recent Christian political activists.
Yes. Yes, he's had a huge effect, well, for sure on me, but he was writing more in the 70s and during the Vietnam War and earlier, the Civil Rights Movement. And so he thought of the dominant power in the world at the time as the United States. Things have shifted now, and from my perspective, the dominant power, that corporations have grown in power and have established together with the other institutions, such as the United States and other wealthy nations, have established a new domination system. That's Walter Wink, who takes a lot of his thinking from William Stringfellow. He talks about the interlocking network of economic, political, military, and even religious powers that dominate the world at any particular time. He talks about, and so do I, about Jesus's time when the military and political and economic powers were dominating the world put Jesus to death for resisting, for not following what they were telling him he should do. And that interlocking network, the domination system, is at different times in history looks different, and right now it looks like, in my opinion, the institutions that make up the global economy and its enforcement mechanisms, the military-industrial complex of the United States.
The picture you draw is pretty bleak and pretty horrifying, but in the end you are still hopeful that it can be resisted.
I'm very hopeful, because even though we don't hear about it on the media that, as we have to remember, much of the media is dominated by corporations. We hear about it on KVMR. We hear about it on Democracy Now. We hear about it on programs, the different programming. But on the mainline media, the people that depend upon that for their information about world events don't hear a whole lot about it. But there are alternatives taking, you know, people are acting in different ways all around the world. There are small groups such as our groups here in Nevada City, Apple working for a sustainable post-petroleum economy, Circle that has done so much work over these years to preserve the river, and so many other organizations. And this is happening all over the world. And then local groups are reaching out and joining together with regional groups and regional groups across borders to other groups even around the country. And it's creating a whole, not just a coalition of people working for global peace, justice, and sustainability, but a global movement that Kofi Annan said civil society is the world's other superpower. And I know that that's true. And I know that there's much more that we can be doing. And my book is written as a call essentially to the church, because that's my context and that's the language I speak. But what churches can do and other faith communities, and there's so much that we can do to help plant the seeds for a more hopeful future.
That was the Reverend Sharon Delgado, the United Methodist minister, Nevada City resident. I talked with her last week about her new book, Shaking the Gates of Hell, Faith-Led Resistance to Corporate Globalization, which has been recently published by Fortress Press. She'll be presenting the book at the bookseller in Grass Valley, not this Wednesday, the following Wednesday, the 24th at 3 p.m. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'm scrambling to fit in all the talks I've had or I'm about to have on upcoming and current events in Nevada County. So I'm going to rush ahead to Gary Wright, who's one of the main actors and writers with the Foothill Theater Company in Nevada City. He recently wrote, and right now Foothill is producing, a wonderful production called Evermore, based on the last 8 years of Edgar Allan Poe's life. I talked to him at his house in Grass Valley last week.
You say in your program notes to Evermore that you originally planned to do a sort of Edgar Allan Poe pastiche. You were going to adapt a number of his works to this for the stage and string them along, but somehow you veered away from that and started getting into the man himself.
That's right, yeah. In fact, the first thing I did was adapted a couple of stories and the poem Annabel Lee. I adapted those to the stage and discovered that they didn't really take that long to get through. You know, the stories aren't all that long, and without adding a bunch of material, I discovered that I didn't even have really an entire act, you know, let alone a full evening of theater. So I changed my thinking and thought, well, I need to either find a lot more stories and a lot more poems or find another way to tell this story. And so I started researching Poe and read some biographies, and I came across references to a couple of things that really piqued my interest, and they were personal relationships of his. One was his relationship with his wife, Virginia, which was a very sweet, tender love story. And I had never read this about Poe, that he and his wife were so in love with each other, and that she was tragically taken from him at a young age by tuberculosis.
As had been his mother and his foster mother.
So I was drawn to that, to thinking of Poe in this happy domestic relationship, because that kind of skewed my thinking about him in a way that it didn't match what I had heard about him. You know, he didn't seem like a guy who would be domestically happy. And so I started thinking of
him. You thought he was like his characters.
Sure, which I think a lot of people think, unless they read a lot about him. And then I found references to this guy, Rufus Griswold, who was a very powerful editor at the time and was in Poe's life quite a bit. And they started out as more or less friends and business partners. And gradually, as they got to know each other better and better, their friendship became one of the great enmities in the history of literature. And it was all over petty stuff, just petty, niggly things that Poe did to Griswold and then that Griswold did back to Poe. And they just kept one-upping each other. They were like little boys.
In the play, the suggestion is that Poe actually made attacks on Griswold, either direct or veiled, but ones that most readers would recognize.
Yeah, he did, but Poe was, at the time, Poe was best known as a critic. And that was mainly what he did for Graham's Magazine, was write literary criticism. And so he didn't just pick on Griswold, he picked on everybody. And Poe was known as a harsh critic. And, you know, he made a lot of enemies that way.
You have him going after Emerson and Longfellow and all of the big names of the time.
As he did, yeah. No cow was too sacred for Poe. He went after everybody. And the more famous and respected they were, the more he seemed to enjoy it.
So he and Griswold had a falling out. He lost the editorship of Graham's Magazine to Griswold, but he still left Griswold as his literary executor.
Yeah, interesting. That's an interesting thing. I don't know exactly how it happened that Poe selected Griswold as his literary executor. Do you? Have you found that in your reading? But I presume that it happened when they were getting along. And then, you know, they have this falling out and their relationship deteriorates and they become enemies, but probably Poe's last will and testament wasn't the first thing on his mind, you know, and he certainly didn't think he was going to die at the age of 40 when he went on a trip to Baltimore. So I guess, you know, if he had thought of it, he probably would have gotten around to changing his will, but it just didn't occur to him.
It didn't occur to him, so Griswold went after him with a vengeance after he died, edited his letters rather brutally to change the tone of the person who was writing them, and wrote an introduction to his collected works that made him out to be intemperate, unreliable, a dozen other things, a dope fiend and alcoholic and everything he could throw at him.
Yeah, it's true. In fact, Griswold's biography of Poe, which was... we didn't mention, actually, Griswold brought out the first complete works of Poe's writings, his tales, his poems, and everything after Poe died. That was what Griswold did as literary executor. And in this complete works, he included a biographical sketch of Edgar Allan Poe. And this sketch, as you said, was full of slanders and lies, and became the accepted source on all things Edgar Allan Poe for the next century, almost. You know, so all of Griswold's filthy lies about the kind of person Poe was were accepted as the gospel truth for a long time.
So what you're essentially doing in the play is correcting the record and also trying to explain how it happened that Griswold came to this state of mind.
Yeah, well, I guess that's what I started with, was I was fascinated by Griswold's hate for Poe and why he would go to all this trouble to drag Poe's name through the mud after Poe was dead. And that's not all Griswold did either. He also got Poe's mother-in-law to sign a power of attorney granting Griswold the right to negotiate all the terms with the publishers for sales of this book of Poe's works. And Griswold used that power of attorney to cut Poe's heirs out of the money from Poe's writings and put himself in a position to profit from them. And I couldn't imagine how somebody could be so ruthless, so cold, so awful.
In the play, you give his religious feelings some of the credit for that.
A little bit. Well, Griswold, I don't play that up very much, but Griswold actually was a Baptist minister, which is why he was why he's allowed to call himself Dr. Griswold, which is, in the play, is very important to him.
But the other characters, Griswold is the one who at first is Poe's genial friend, but gradually they get nastier and nastier to each other. But Poe, his wife, and his mother-in-law are always a loving household. In dire straits, they have no money, she is sick, but they do everything they can to entertain one another and keep one another happy.
Yeah, and by all accounts, that's pretty accurate. They got along very, very well, and Poe considered his mother-in-law as, you know, very much as his own mother, too. And they all took very good care of each other. His mother-in-law actually, while Sissy, his wife, was dying of tuberculosis, and Poe was struggling with dealing with that, his mother-in-law used to take his writings around town, and she would peddle them to the newspapers and the magazines around town for him, because he couldn't quite deal with the business aspect of that. You know, he would stay home and write, or stay home and drink, or just stay home and be with Sissy. And Mrs. Clem would go out and push these works.
You say drink, but he really had almost no tolerance for alcohol. The reputation is that he was something of a lush, but he tended to avoid alcohol because he knew he couldn't handle it. Yet when his wife got so sick, he did tend to drink more than he knew he should.
Yeah, absolutely right, Eric. And that's, yeah, the pain of her, of dealing with her illness, was exactly what drove him to the bottle. And it's true, he would take one drink and be very intoxicated, and then he would not be able to stop drinking, and he would always make himself sick. And what I've read is that when he would go on a drinking bout, he would have blackouts, and he would do things that he wouldn't remember, and then he would be laid up sick for a week at a time afterwards, because it wreaked havoc on his system.
And made it harder and harder for him to make a living, which was a precarious business to begin with.
Absolutely.
He was essentially a literary journalist, and that's always been a hard road to hoe, no matter what time.
Yeah, certainly.
As he and Griswold fell out, you have him making Griswold the character in several of his best-known stories, tales.
Right.
That he, in The Telltale Heart and in The Cask of Amontillado, well, two of the characters. I was going to say villains, but in either case are they villains. In The Telltale Heart, it's just a totally creepy madman. Mm-hmm. In Cask of Amontillado, it's a
he's the victim, really.
He's the victim. Yeah. He's pompous and overbearing, but he's the one who gets walled up.
Yeah.
And you decide that Poe might have been digging at Griswold a bit when he wrote these tales.
Well, I do present the tales and poems chronologically in the order that Poe wrote them, and I followed the timelines of what Poe was publishing along with what was happening in his relationships with Sissy and with Griswold. And so just kind of putting those things together, that was how I saw the story, was that he could very well have had Griswold in mind as he was writing these things.
And when he wrote The Raven, he took it to Griswold at Graham's Magazine and tried to sell it. Griswold turned it down.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. He I don't think we mentioned that Poe was editor at Graham's Magazine in Philadelphia for quite a while, and when he started drinking and became unreliable, Mr. Graham fired him and hired Griswold in his place. And Poe actually did come into work one day and find Griswold sitting at his desk. And that's how he found out that he'd been replaced and that Griswold had replaced him. So that created quite a rift in their relationship, as you can imagine. But after that, Graham's Magazine continued to be a place where Poe was able to publish as a freelance writer. They would take his stuff. You know, he was kind of a favored contributor of Graham's. And that went on until Griswold asked Poe to write a review of his book, Poets and Poetry of America. And Poe wrote a mostly favorable review, but he took the opportunity to take a few swipes at Griswold in the review, which infuriated Griswold. And this is what most historians say caused Griswold to just go overboard and drag Poe's name through the mud after he was dead, was that he was so infuriated by this particular review. And what I noticed in looking at the chronology of Poe's works and where he published things is that after that review of Poets and Poetry of America, he never published anything in Grahams again. But he did take, when he wrote The Raven, he did take it to Grahams and tried to sell it to them, and they turned it down.
But gave him some money anyway.
It was a very humiliating scene. Apparently, Mr. Graham assembled all the editors and the copy boys and even pulled some people in off the street. And Poe gave a dramatic reading of The Raven. The audience apparently was just kind of baffled by it, and they passed a hat, and Poe went home with about $15, completely humiliated.
You give a slightly abbreviated version of that scene as what's really the dramatic climax of the play, and you call the play Evermore, obviously playing on the words Nevermore. Do you see The Raven as being particularly emblematic of Poe?
Absolutely. I had always admired The Raven anyway. You know, some people love it, some people don't. But I think it's just a technically brilliant piece of writing. And its meter is so complicated. It's kind of like jazz, you know. It feels kind of syncopated to me. And it's so perfect. And the rhyme scheme, the interior rhyme scheme is kind of dazzling, I think. It's a dazzling achievement for that kind of poetry, and sustained for a long time. You know, 18 stanzas. They make much of the length of the poem in the play, and I just love it. And finding out that he wrote The Raven while Virginia was dying of consumption in the next room just made me see the poem in a different way. You know, it becomes very clear when you realize those were his circumstances, that he was thinking about what life was going to be like when she finally died, and coming to grips with the fact that he's never going to see her again. And he doesn't comfort himself with the usual Judeo-Christian suppositions about, well, we'll be together in heaven or anything. He takes a very dark and very agnostic view of it, I think, which is that she's going to be gone and I'm never going to see her again. And that's just the way it's going to be. And how am I going to deal with that?
And then the other poem that fits in so well into your play is Annabel Lee, which I did not realize until now was perhaps the last thing he ever wrote before he collapsed and died in the streets of Baltimore.
Yeah, in fact, it was found among his personal effects after he died there in Baltimore. This complete works of his that Griswold put together after he died, they rushed that thing together so quickly that it was already at the printer, and they were barely able to get Annabel Lee to the printer in time to be included in that complete works.
Virginia Poe was much younger than Edgar, and he sort of plays on that in Annabel Lee as being the love of two children, really,
yeah,
in a sense.
Yeah, and by all accounts, that's what their relationship was like. You know, there are rumors that their marriage was unconsummated, but that they were like kids. You know, that they just enjoyed spending time with each other, and it was just a very warm, loving, possibly non-sexual union.
And you bring out her mischievous side and her playful side, but also her she's slightly tormented as well, not to the degree that Edgar was, or I shouldn't say Edgar, she would have called him Eddie.
Right.
And her mother called him Eddie, mm-hmm. But she had her share of melancholy and of disease, I guess I'd say, unease, which she usually managed to sort of wash away with her playfulness, but that was a side of her that I did not know anything about.
Well, nor did I, actually. I tried to write someone. The historical portrayal of Sissy didn't really give me much to hang my hat on. What I read was that she probably didn't read his stuff or appreciate it very much, and I couldn't figure out why he loved her so much. So what I did was I tried to create a character that I would be in love with, and tried, and at the same time tried to make her a good match for Eddie.
That was Gary Wright, the playwright of Evermore, a production based on the last 8 years of Edgar Allan Poe's life, which is running from now till the 27th of October at the Foothill Theater Company in Nevada City. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be here till 2 o'clock. I mentioned at the beginning of the program that there were many things coming up in the next 2 weeks that I wanted to feature. One of them is the publication, or the real launch, of a wonderful anthology called Open to All, What the Library Means to Me, which is published by Comstock Bonanza Press for the Nevada County Library Foundation. I assume that means that the money is going to the Nevada County Library Foundation. The person who's going to answer that question is Molly Fisk, who used to be part of Booktown all the time. And it's really good to have you back, Molly.
Thank you. Yes, every last cent is going to buy more books for the library.
And I also have in the room Chris Olander, who is going to talk about another subject a little later in the program, but as I look through the book today, I realize that he's one of the contributors as well, and he's one of the people who's going to be reading at the party next week. First, tell us a little bit about the party.
We're doing a reading to launch this anthology, which is a fabulous Christmas gift in case you're getting organized. The reading is Friday, October 26th at 7 o'clock at the Madeline Helling Community Room of the Nevada County Library.
Now, the book must have 60 or 70 contributors?
I think 85.
85. And about how many are going to read at the party?
I think we have 14.
And they're
randomly chosen. We were trying to figure out what order to put them in to read, and we tried age, height, you know, hair color, and then we just did it randomly also.
When you say we, the main people involved in this from the very beginning were you, fellow poet Steve Sandfield, and the former Nevada County librarian Steve Felstead.
That's right.
But Steve, the second Steve Felstead, has left us. He's moved on to another library closer to where he grew up.
South Pasadena. He's having a blast down there, as far as I can tell.
But this was a project that I guess it was his idea, I believe, but he enlisted you and Steve Sandfield because you were the people whose taste he trusted to pick among the many entries. How many entries were there?
About 160. We took I think we took half of the people who came.
And in it, some of them, most of them are very short. I don't think there's anything longer than 2 pages. There's poems. Oh, actually, the one long thing is 4 pages, and that's a poem by Steve Sandfield. And Steve Sandfield normally never writes anything more than about 100 words.
He's a master of haiku as well as many other things, and he does keep it short. So, yeah.
But anyway, I was hoping to actually rib him a bit about his verbosity.
I will tell him that he should call you up immediately if he wants to be ribbed.
Okay. Anyway, but most of the others are quite short. Some of them are by professional writers. Some of them, well, one of them, I'm just looking at this, is by the publisher of the Union. There are 3 or 4 librarians involved at least.
And several librarian spouses.
Aha. Who are the spouses? Oh, yeah, Bob Lavelle.
Bob Lavelle. And right. Maybe he's the only one. I kept thinking it was nice to have the librarian's perspective and then the spouse perspective.
Right, and Bob Lavelle, whose wife Jenny Long is one of the librarians in Grass Valley, his poem is really in praise of librarians. Molly's piece is in praise of the sorts of things you can do in libraries when you're not reading books.
And young.
And young and reckless.
Risky.
And Chris started out writing about reading to your children, but then wound up reading in the library.
Yeah, that was my piece was a shortened version of my life story of what really made me become a human being.
How long is that story?
Oh, it's probably about another 15 or 20 pages, maybe more. Maybe a book. Who knows? We'll see.
That's good.
Was there a particular, what were the guidelines you gave people when you asked for submissions?
We just gave them the title of the book and wanted to know what the library meant to them. The reason that this whole thing got started, actually, I think it is because of me. Steve Yelsud and I were driving back and forth to Sacramento a couple different times to go to meetings together. And I was thinking a lot about a friend of mine who had said to me that her mom was pretty chilly when they were growing up, and that the real place where she changed was the library, and what a gift it had been for this mother to take her daughter to the library, and how much that had mattered and still mattered to the daughter, who's a reader and an editor and completely involved with words. So I thought there might be other stories of how important the library was to people. I didn't realize we were going to get so many stories of a person's first library card. There was a kind of, the submissions fell into several categories where there were lots and lots of stories of, on the same kind of theme.
And you did divide it up into four parts. Well, actually five, if you count the illustrations, because there are photographs and drawings by local people. But the first part is a well-read life, then keepers of the culture, anything can happen, and the day I wandered in.
Well, I kind of, I did the order of it because that's my favorite thing. So I grabbed that job out of everybody else's hands. It's not, you know, we didn't put lots of library card pieces right next to each other, but I think there's a pretty nice flow from experience to experience. There are young people represented. I think the youngest is 11. The oldest is probably Meg Pally's piece at age 89. Lots of people who've lived in Nevada City, Grass Valley for a long time. Newcomers have talked about what it was like to come here and see the libraries. People have talked about the library as a place to escape from difficulties at home or getting beaten up on the way home from school, all kinds of different situations.
And you even got a few submissions from people outside of the county, like David Masumoto, who was one of the Nevada County Reads authors a few years ago, author of Epitaph for a Peach, but also Malcolm Margolin and Anne Lamott and Ray Bradbury, who is another person whose book was read.
Well, we tried to have it be in some way connected to the county, and Anne Lamott has read here numerous, numerous times. Gerald Haslam has read here. He's in there also. Those are the big guns. We have several big guns of our own in the county, and one in particular is represented right there.
And who do you have in mind?
I was thinking of Gary Snyder.
Ah. When in the website, at the library website, they mentioned both Gary Snyder and Peter Collier as being Pulitzer Prize winners. And for some reason, I tend to forget about that for Peter, but it's definitely true. It's because they write such completely different sorts of material. Is there anything you think you really learned from this that you didn't know before? I mean, how long was the process?
It was intended to take us about a year and a half, and I think it took three. There were certain stumbling blocks in the way, but it's come out really beautifully. I don't know what I would say I was looking to learn. I was looking to try to give the county a present, more library books being the goal, but this anthology itself being a wonderful representation of who lives here and what they think about and how they sound. And that's what we're trying to do by getting this many readers at a reading on Friday the 26th of October, just to have people hear all these different voices and understand. I mean, probably you would say, if you were asked on the street, you know, generally, do you think Americans like libraries? You would probably say yes, but you wouldn't have thought about it much. And this gives a lot more detail and a lot more, I don't know, it made me much more aware when I went to the library of how many other people besides me use it and how important it is, especially in a rural county like this.
Aside from the roads, it probably is maybe the most widely used county service.
I think so. And it's free, which is important.
Did you write your piece specifically for this, or was it something you had been doodling around?
No, I wrote it as one of my radio commentaries for KVMR, in fact. So it had played here about 6 months before the book came out. And I was being pulled in lots of directions because I'm primarily a poet, and both Steves were saying, you've got to have a poem in here, you've got to have a poem in here. And I just thought, you know, none of my poems are about the library, and I don't really want to write one. You know, I've written love poems to stores, but I'm not good at writing love poems to public institutions. So I went and chose the other piece that was prose.
And you, Chris, you say yours is a shortened version of How You Became Human. Had you written the longer version?
Are you sure you're human already?
Yeah. It was something, the good thing about this whole project is it made me start writing about why I became a poet myself and a writer and a teacher, because it started in a library of all my really good experiences. And it was a refuge from me. It was an escape from bad boys that were going to beat me up. It was also an escape from a lot of problems I was having in classes in the school I was going to in Sacramento. So also it was a discovery from my children. My children brought me into the classroom to have them read stories, because their teacher put them to sleep. And so that's really what got me going. And I realized that I had a little bit of a talent for that, and I wanted to keep it going.
Now, I don't know if this is the right question to ask you, but you mentioned reading to your children in 1972 and then going to college in 1978. Is that the correct?
It's 1976 is when I started.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you had become a family. You were a father long before you were full-time.
I was a father when I was 20 years old, which was really good for me, I thought, because I was still a kid at that time too, and so I had a good relationship with them, and it really taught me about responsibility and what we're here in a community, how we feed off each other and feed each other. So it was a good experience for me.
And did reading to them have something to do with your going back to school?
Oh, definitely. I just liked, I had an ability to do that. And then after I got out of school, out of a BA program, I've got a book by Eric Bettelheim, I believe it was, and he was talking about the enchantment of what reading does for your children. And it's really a necessity to read to your children. I think every parent should do that. It not only brings them together, but also opens up their imagination and really allows them to experience a lot of different terrors as well as blessings and beautiful moments that they're going to discover in their life.
Bruno.
Yeah, Bruno, that's it, Bruno.
Yeah, the uses of enchantment.
Yes,
yeah. By Bruno Bettelheim. So let's hear once more about the event, then I want to ask Chris about a different event that he's going to be part of.
So there is a reading and community introduction of this anthology, Open to All, What the Library Means to Me. It's on Friday, October 26th at 7 o'clock at the Madeline Helling Community Room at the Main Library in Nevada City. There are going to be 14 readers: Jeff Ackerman, Rue Cantata, Todd Cirillo, Kate Dwyer, Madeline Helling, Chris Irving, Jean McKean, the famous Chris Olander, a human, Meg Pally, Dale Pendle, Laura Pendle, Utah Phillips, Tom Taylor, Lydia Unruh, and possibly others. Steve Sanfield and I will be there to keep everything herded in the right direction. Books will be for sale. There will be refreshments afterwards. And if you want any more information, you can call 265-1407. All proceeds of selling all these books go to purchase more books for the Nevada County Libraries.
Wonderful.
So I'm going to segue into what it was like before I became a human being. Now on Thursday, October 18th at 7:30 p.m. at the Black Box Theater, which is the Offstage Center Theater behind the main building of the Center for the Arts, we're going to do a 50th anniversary reading of Jack Kerouac's On the Road. Now, if you really read that book and you want to know what I was like before I became human, that's what it was like. So if you come on this night, Thursday, October 18th, 7:30 p.m., you can hear us read about those characters that we all were at one time and hopefully have grown out of.
Now, I know that, or I not only know, I notice that on the flyer, the readers are listed as B.L. Kennedy, Matt Amott, Philip T. Nails, Noel Kropelin, Todd Cirillo, and J.C. Olander. Is that your human name?
Yeah, that's my initials for my full name.
Julia Child Olander.
There you've got it. And all these people are going to read, and they all have some background in the On the Road novel. So it should be a good reading. We're going to read about 15 minutes each, and then we're going to have an open mic afterwards. It's $5 general and $1 for those under 18, and refreshments are included. Open mic following the featured performers.
Now, when you say each 15 minutes, are you going to read consecutively, or did you each pick a particular section?
We each picked sections that we wanted to read from, so hopefully there's not going to be any crossover. And these, this is a real big reading down in Sacramento. It's been going on for a long time, called The Railroad Earth, which is a tribute to Kerouac. I think all of these people here that are reading have the mindset in which they're going to pick different pieces to read. I'm really looking forward to what Noel Copeland has to read because, you know, this On the Road is really kind of a chauvinistic, macho look at what adolescent adult young men go through. Many of them.
Is it the opposite of chick lit?
It could be.
I'm not sure we can say that on the radio, but you could probably figure it out. It's a good rhyme.
Yeah, okay. So I'm looking forward to it. It'll be a lot of fun. Reading this book, On the Road, I didn't read this book until 1992. And rereading this book, you can really see there was a real different change in the American mentality as to who the everyday ideals were. There was a crashing down of this idealism, what we're supposed to strive for with economics and academia, and it came down to the working class middleman. These are the new heroes, or these are the everyman person. So it was a good book to get into.
I haven't read it since I was 15. My daughter read it 2 or 3 years ago when she was maybe 21, somewhere around there. I've never really asked her what she thought of it, but I think I will.
Yeah,
it's famous for being liked more by men than by women. But I think it was a man who. What's that rude remark that's been always made about On the Road?
By
Truman Capote.
That's not writing. That's typing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. To wrap up real quickly, all of the events we've been discussing, the reading from On the Road will be Thursday, October 18th at 7:30 p.m. at the off-center stage behind the Center for the Arts in Grass Valley. It'll be, as I said, at 7:30 p.m. You can get more information at 432-8196. And the
Open to All is on Friday the 26th, 7 p.m., the Madeline Helling Room of the Nevada County Library.
And the one of the things I discussed earlier, the play Evermore by Gary Wright is running at the Nevada Theater. The Foothill Theater production will continue Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays through the 27th of October. And finally, Reverend Sharon Delgado will be presenting her book, Shaking the Gates of Hell, Faith-Led Resistance to Corporate Globalism, at the Bookseller on Wednesday the 24th at 3 p.m. And I'm going to say, no, that's all I'm going to say right now. We're going to get out of here because Jimmy Accardi has to get in. Thanks, you guys, for coming in. Oh, and there's Molly is more on top of these things than I am, even though she's not part of this program, because when she was part of this program, we had underwriters.
We did.
And now we don't, but I would really like to thank for their support of KBMR, the Ray Morgan Company, offering Canon's complete line of digital copiers, fax machines, and printers. Ray Morgan Company provides local sales and service with offices in Nevada City, Marysville, Rockland, Stockton, and Chico. Their number is 530-478-9298, or you can go to raymorgan.com on your computer.